Wisconsin's Afternoon News is on the air, broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. Here are your hosts, Jessica Tai and Julia Fellow.
Welcome, welcome, my co-pilot for the next 3 hours. You heard it, Jessica Tai, so happy you're with us.
It's the ladies' afternoon. Thanks for having me.
It is, including producer Sam.
That's true.
And Debbie Lozaga.
Yes.
Wow.
All across the board today.
Jessica, we're so happy to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I lost my phone. I don't know where it is, but I'm sure that my face is right on it, so somebody will give it to me.
I was like, did I just steal your phone or just pick your phone? No, this is mine. I got it.
All right, Sam, let's get right to it.
This is the three at 3 on Wisconsin's Afternoon News.
What's number one, Jessica?
How about a 3-day Super Bowl weekend?
I like it. I don't know about you, but this is something NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell would like to see. He wants to see fewer preseason games, all right? So that the Super Bowl would fall on President's Day weekend, and we could make a whole party of it all weekend. Everyone could have Monday off. The goal is for more viewers and fans to be able to enjoy it without sacrificing sleep and work.
Oh, okay. How about that? You can party longer and you don't sacrifice sleep or work? Who's not going to take that?
Absolutely. All right, number two.
Number two, The Daily Show coming here to Milwaukee.
Yeah, Daily Show and Jon Stewart coming to the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee this summer. A sign of more big names that will be in Bruce City August 19th through the 22nd. The Daily Show with Jon Stewart will be at the Democratic Convention in Chicago as well. Much more to come.
Number three, where's my wallet? Check your dollar bills.
Fantastic. Okay, so your dollar bill, if you text, by the way, watch to 855-616-1620. Our producer Sam has a photo of the markers to look for from the Treasury Department. So your dollar bill could be a rare one that people are looking for. It could be worth, Jessica, up to $150,000. So what you're looking for are misprints. That's what they love. It went into circulation and collectors are going wild for it. The series date right next to it is the first sign that you have it. It's right next to George Washington. It must read series 2013. The bill must have a B, Federal Reserve seal, above the serial number. And then the serial numbers must end with a star and fall between B00001, B0025, or B032 to B096, all with an asterisk at the end. Again, if you text WATCH to 855-616-1620, you can see it. Take a screen grab. Do you have it?
Well, I was going to pull up my wallet when you were telling us this. I thought, let me see if I have a one. I didn't think I did, but I thought, oh, maybe. Shoot, I don't have any ones. I just have a 10. Do you ever have old money, though, and you want to go give it to somebody, and then it's so old it doesn't look like the new stuff anymore, so you worry, I hope they don't think this is fake.
I know.
Have you ever had that? I'm a rule follower, and sometimes I'm like, this looks so old.
I had a very old $100 bill. I'm like, oof, this better go through.
Yeah, where'd that baby come from, right? It's an old one.
All right, up next, we've spoken about the bird flu being a problem in our milk. Why the U.S. Department of Agriculture is now testing beef? It's 313 on WTMJ. Bird flu concerns in the U.S. after finding the virus in some dairy cows in several states. The USDA says they will sample ground beef now. This is something that your co-host, Greg Matzik, was talking about. So it's going to be tested in the same states where dairy cows have tested positive for the virus. They say they're going to do this by sampling ground beef at retail stores in states where the cattle have tested positive, sampling beef muscle from sick dairy cows, and conducting experiments that test cooking ground beef to various temperatures. Authorities say that all U.S. meat supply is safe, so that's good to know.
Yeah, they're basically conducting three tests. As you mentioned, sampling the ground beef that was purchased at grocery stores. They're also taking samples of muscle tissue from sick cows. And then the one I thought was the most fascinating was the cooking study. The USDA will inoculate ground beef with a virus surrogate and cook it to different temperatures to see how much virus is killed under each heat setting. So it's like, okay, we cooked it at this temperature. Is the virus still there? I just find that so fascinating. It's a cooking experiment. But the bottom line is you don't want your burger with bird flu.
No. So we told you yesterday about the Food and Drug Administration found 1 in 5 commercial milk samples tested in a nationwide survey contain particles of the bird flu. The virus has been found in 34 cattle herds across 9 states, according to the Department of Agriculture. The federal agency says they remain confident the nation's meat supply is safe. The belief is that the pasteurization process makes the virus inactive, so you can ingest it and you will not be sickened. Meanwhile, there's reports of bottlenose dolphins in Florida that have died from bird flu. The first dolphin in the U.S. just died from the virus. The human risk, just one confirmed case. A farmer who contracted bird flu in Texas and is said to be doing just fine. This is what Dr. Celine Gounder on CBS News says scientists are already looking out for next.
Do we see pigs infected? Pigs have traditionally been the mixing vessel for human and bird flu, and that's how you get these Frankenstein scary flus. That's what we have a bit of a blind spot on right now, and so we need to be digging more into that.
And is the government doing enough, and the FDA and farmers? What are we hearing about how these cases are being reported or how they're taking care of this?
You know, big picture, I think there could be more transparency and cooperation, whether USDA or farmers allowing the USDA and public health people onto farms to do the testing. Some of the workers are not trustful of the government and so don't want to come forward for testing. Mm. So everybody needs to be working better together.
We will continue to stay on top of this. We don't want this to hit our hardworking farmers here in Wisconsin. It's 3:19 on WTMJ. Up next, we've entered our second day of protest at UW-Milwaukee's campus over the war in Gaza. Julian Johnson joins us next. All right. It's Tuesday. That means it's time for Ticket Tuesday, where we partner up with Vienna Beef to send you and a friend to the next Brewers Tuesday home game. This one's for Tuesday, May 14th versus the Pittsburgh Pirates. Lucky caller number, Jessica, what number?
7.
Number 7 gets the pair of tickets this week. All right.
Yeah, thanks for letting me pick the number.
Absolutely.
I haven't done that on my own show yet. Greg's always happy with his numbers. He's like, oh yeah, 3, 5. No, thank you.
We have now entered our second day of protests on UW-Milwaukee's campus over the war in Gaza. Our Julian Johnson has been on the ground there talking to protesters. Julian, thanks for joining us.
No problem, Julia.
What's going on there right now? Do you see the demonstrators right now camping out?
Actually, I don't know if you guys can hear, but they're actually about to do a press conference right now, talking about more about what they're going to be doing moving forward. Right now, they're actually currently setting up more barricades. Ever since I came here, they've already had barricades, but I saw them literally hammering down nails on new barricades, as well as people are having all their food and everything. They're really prepared to go the long run, the distance with this protest.
Julian, what's the demand? What do the students want?
So the demand, there's a multitude of different demands. They talked a little bit about it with me. They've been talking to UWM administration for over 6 months. They've given them a list of demands, and this was the last straw. It was about divesting and basically cutting ties with anything dealing with Israel in terms of the war in Gaza.
So TMJ4's Mary Jo Ola was live out there midday, said things were quiet. So from what you're seeing, things are starting to ramp up. Are people chanting right now? I hear something in the background.
Yes, they are chanting right now. There's a huge group going on. I actually have the other phone recording everything that's happening right now as well as I do this. But yeah, it's getting lively. They're doing the Free Palestine chant and amongst other things, and it's really starting to gather up and get lively around here.
About how many people do you think are out there?
I would say we're definitely across 100. It's a pretty big group. The circle is getting bigger and bigger. I mean, people are basically standing right next to the encampment areas. They're getting closer to the sidewalk area right here near Kenwood. I think it's Kenwood Road or Avenue, whichever one it is. But it's getting big.
Have they given any idea as to how long they're going to keep those tents out there, how long they're going to stay out there?
Again, they said, and I talked to multiple different people, they will stay out here as long as it takes to have their demands met. That's why they have an outpouring of support from some faculty, some people in the community. People are serving up food to them. They're giving them water. They're giving them multiple different resources while they're actually in the last final weeks of school. So they're prepared to even do this even past these final 2 weeks of school while doing their homework, while doing the regular tasks, as long as it takes for the demands to be met.
Wow, Julian, thank you so much. Julian Johnson reporting from UW-Milwaukee. We'll have updates from you throughout our newscast. Thank you.
No problem.
The university did release a statement yesterday reiterating that the UWM Foundation is a separate legal entity. Jessica from the university and UWM has no control over the mutual fund investments made by the foundation with all the demands that they're making to divest. The school maintains the foundation cannot divest from individual companies within those funds. The governor was also asked about this today. Hear from him.
We've had conversations all during this several days that this has been happening, and we'll continue to do that. And hopefully we'll have peaceful resolution. But I also say that we have to make sure that the protesters are doing it peacefully, thoughtfully, and frankly not making some of their colleagues or their classmates feeling uncomfortable, which is happening somewhat, but that's just a warning. I've been involved with protests in my own world in 1969 when I was a freshman at UW-Madison. You do it in the proper way and you can make some progress.
Hillel, Milwaukee, which is located just across the street from this demonstration going on where Julian is, released a statement late yesterday asking members of the Jewish community to stay away from the protests. So this is making national news right now. I saw UW-Milwaukee on Fox News, CNN, NBC this morning. So we are now in the national spotlight and everybody's looking at what's going to happen next.
Well, yeah, students across the country were protesting and now it's happening right here in our area in Milwaukee.
Yep. Your top stories, traffic and weather are next.
Wisconsin's Afternoon News on WTMJ.
A huge collaboration by the Associated Press, the Howard Centers for Investigative Journalism, and Frontline CBS. They found dozens of deaths which reveal the risks of injecting sedatives into people who are being restrained by police. These sedatives include ketamine. A special on this is airing tonight at 9 p.m. on Frontline PBS. Associated Press investigative reporter Ryan J. Foley found at least 94 people have died after they were given sedatives and restrained by police from 2012 to 2021. Two of those cases were here in Wisconsin. We covered the one in Eau Claire yesterday. In part two, we're covering the one in 2017 that took place here in West Milwaukee. That's where our conversation picks back up.
Adam Trammell's case is an example of how the role of sedatives in these cases, in these deaths, and the use of sedatives, they often get overlooked where the investigation, the public scrutiny focuses on what the police did and not necessarily the types of medical treatment that the paramedics provided after the use of force incident. So with Adam Trammell, his case got quite a bit of attention because he was repeatedly shocked with a taser while he was in the bathtub after officers had responded to a welfare check call at his apartment. And it's really disturbing video that had been made public previously, and the West Milwaukee City, I believe, settled that case. But when you watch the body cam video, there's another significant part of it, which is after he's been repeatedly tased, he's in handcuffs, he's on his side, and they had dragged him out of his apartment. He was out in the hallway. First, he's injected with ketamine, and that appears to cause him to vomit, which is it's a side effect that we see in some of these cases. And then shortly thereafter, they inject him with a second drug, midazolam, and he, within minutes, according to the body cam, it looks like he develops breathing problems, and he died later that day.
And what was the reason why they decided to inject him with ketamine and midazolam? Was it because he was still resisting after being tased?
Yeah, I think they were trying to calm him down, which is what I think they would say, he was still being combative, at least when they gave him the ketamine. But you can take a look at the video to see the circumstances around the second injection, whether he was still combative or if he was already starting to calm down at that point.
Of the 94 cases, it's interesting that you show like what some of the law enforcement or the people who are about to inject the person in the buttocks say. What are some disturbing things that you've heard?
Yeah, I was just doing an interview about a case that happened down in Florida in Orlando, and that was an example of where, and we saw this in at least three different videos across the country, where, yeah, officers and paramedics were just sort of joking about the power of these medications and saying, night-night, and making some jokes about what was going to happen. And obviously they weren't expecting the person to die, but it's certainly not good optics.
And with Adam Trammell, he passed away too. Did you look into the cause of death with that?
Yes. Adam Trammell's cause of death was listed as excited delirium, which, as we've discussed, is often the condition that, you know, sedatives injections are supposed to treat. And in his case, interestingly, they did sort of cite the use of sedatives as a contributing factor, because they said that a struggle with physical, electrical, and chemical restraint were significant conditions that involved in his death. So there was an acknowledgement that both the use of the taser and the use of sedatives played at least some role there.
And did you talk to Adam's family at all?
I talked to the family's attorney.
What did they think about the settlement?
You know, that case was focused more on the taser, and it was seen as a big case related to the role taser plays in death, and it wasn't really challenging necessarily the use of sedatives that followed.
There's a big racial disparity that you highlighted out of the 94 deaths. How many were people of color who died?
Yeah, 47 of the 94 who died were black across the country.
So what is the next step? We're going to air this on PBS at 9 p.m., but what is going on with the DOJ? Do they still stand by ketamine and other sleeping agents to be used and injected in anyone? It could be one of us.
Nationwide, the use of ketamine and other sedatives during incidents that might also involve the police, there's a reexamination happening. And part of this goes to the death of Elijah McClain in Aurora, Colorado in 2019. He was a young man who was walking home from a convenience store. He was stopped and restrained by the police, who were responding to a report of a, quote, sketchy person. And he was injected with ketamine eventually, and he died. And just Friday, the second paramedic who was convicted in his death was sentenced to 14 months in jail with work release privileges, and the first paramedic was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Those convictions in that case has EMS agencies across the country reexamining their policies on when it's appropriate to use, you know, ketamine and other sedatives, retraining people. And in general, there's been an acknowledgement that maybe in the past, some of these agencies were too quick to use sedation in these cases, and they're going to have sort of a higher bar for doing so in the future.
This investigative report will air on Frontline PBS tonight at 9. I want to thank Ryan J. Foley for his time. Part one of this two-part investigation and discussion about his investigation is on our podcast right now. So if you text WAN, it stands for Wisconsin's After News, to 855-616-1620. Boom. It takes you right there to our full page, and you can listen to part one. That's 855-616-1620. Just text WAN. Up next, the former president was fined for violating a gag order in the ongoing hush money trial. Legal analyst Royal Oaks joins us next at 3:45 to talk about that. The time right now is 3:42 on WTMJ. Former President Donald Trump fined for violating a gag order. We've been waiting to find out what the judge's decision would be. We have ABC News legal analyst Royal Oaks joining us on the line. Royal, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Judge's patience has run out. He was presented with 10 possible violations of the gag order, which said, thou shalt not speak ill of witnesses or jurors. And the judge agreed with the DA that at least in 9 of those 10 cases, Trump had violated the rule, $1,000 a pop. And the judge said, and by the way, I'll jail you for contempt if you keep doing this. And we're going to have a hearing on additional allegations for more purported violations of gag order. That's going to be Thursday morning. So more to come on the gag order front.
ABC News legal analyst Royal Oaks joins us on the line right now. So happy that you're with us. You've been following every step of this case. Can you tell us about, okay, so there were 10. It would be a $1,000 fine for each of them. He was fined for 9, so that's $9,000. Do you know what some of them were that they were the most egregious?
Yeah, basically, Donald Trump's been going after Michael Cohen. And so he says that the guy's a liar and he's been convicted of perjury and so on. So the judge challenged Donald Trump's lawyer in court recently. The lawyer said, well, Donald Trump was just responding to attacks by the witnesses. And the judge said, well, what exactly were these attacks by Cohen? And Donald Trump's lawyer didn't have the examples. And the judge got very impatient, said, you really lost credibility with me. So that's what it's about. I mean, the judge acknowledged that Donald Trump has a point in this sense. If a witness like Michael Cohen goes on network TV and starts trashing Donald Trump, the judge agrees that Donald Trump may well have a right, even though there's this gag order saying don't say anything bad about witnesses. He may have a right to fight back. But so far, the judge hasn't seen examples of the attacks by witnesses. Then, of course, there are the jurors. Donald Trump suggested that the jury pool was a bunch of left-leaning activists who just want to get Trump. And that was a violation of the judge's order. So a lot of statements by Trump. The weird thing is Donald Trump possibly would invite incarceration, because just as his indictments and his mugshots, his fingerprinting helped him last year raise money and go rocket up in the polls, he may feel that this would help. I mean, the Trump TV ads would write themselves. Donald Trump is behind bars, put there by a Democrat DA and a Democrat judge. Meanwhile, Joe Biden is jetting around the country campaigning. So maybe Donald Trump would like it if the judge put the hammer down and actually put him in jail.
You know, I've been on TikTok every day, and it seems like Michael Cohen's on all the time, live streaming. How is he allowed to do that if he's going to be a witness in this case?
Well, he, as a witness, is entitled to exercise his right to free speech. He is not entitled to hobnob and confer with other witnesses in the case, because judges often say, now, you know, we don't want you tailoring your testimony. Unless and until he attacks Donald Trump, the judge would say Trump may not respond. Now, interestingly, on your point, I just saw this morning that Michael Cohen has said, out of respect to the judge and the prosecutors, I'm going to stop talking on social media about Donald Trump. So you're right. There have been lots of attacks on TikTok and elsewhere. But as of now, maybe Michael Cohen is changing his strategy, because before too long, he'll be having his star turn on the witness stand. And frankly, all the stuff that's going on today, it's interesting. It's showing that Donald Trump's campaign was in panic mode leading up to the presidential election in November 2016, thus giving a motivation to possibly lie and break the rules with respect to the Stormy hush money. But that's preliminary. The main event of this case is going to be Michael Cohen getting on the stand and looking the jury in the eye and saying, look, there's no smoking gun document that proves that Donald Trump knew we were falsifying records. But I'm here to tell you we talked about it, and he did know it, and it's obvious. Common sense tells you he would know it. And then Trump's lawyer will cross-examine him, and however that exchange turns out might dictate the verdict in this case.
So, Royal, here we are. Former President Donald Trump now fined $9,000 for violating the gag order. If he continues with his violations here, he could be jailed. Is the judge also trying to send a message?
Absolutely. His message is, I get it that you're the former president and you're running for the office again. I get it that that's super important. But even more important is that this trial and the criminal justice system in general can operate without intimidation and fear. You got to operate by following the rules, my rules as the judge. That's the message I think that the judge is trying to send to Donald Trump. The fact that the judge has no use for Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has been in a running feud with the judge, that's just makes it all the more pointed, kind of more attention grabbing for the public. But this kind of thing happens in regular run of the mill cases where judges lose patience with lawyers or witnesses and get pretty angry.
I see the judge is off the bench now that Trump has left the courtroom, so they're wrapped up for the day. Eric Trump, though, the first family member to attend Trump's trial?
Yeah, interestingly, Donald Trump has been in court with his lawyers, of course, but people have noticed that he looks kind of alone and kind of lost and not in his usual in-command situation. And observers have speculated that the strategy shifted this week for Donald Trump's side, where he has a much larger retinue and bodyguards, and Eric Trump, as you say, is the very first family member to attend. So I think they're just trying to present a more muscular image to contrast the idea that he's sitting there sort of helpless at the mercy of the judge, can't really speak, can't really do anything.
That's the one thing I've been wondering, where the kids have been. Yeah, because they're always by their dad. So that makes sense that that at least one of the children showed up. So where are we in the hush money trial? It looks like we're off tomorrow. Trump is visiting Waukesha tomorrow in Wisconsin. So where are we in the trial?
Yeah, so this judge operates on the basis of 4 days a week. He takes Wednesdays off to handle other cases. He's not playing golf. And so Donald Trump will take advantage of that opportunity to go do some campaign rallies. Then we're back with the contempt hearing Thursday and some more testimony the rest of Thursday and Friday. And then it gets kind of interesting because we thought it was going to be, maybe 6, 7, 8 week trial. This judge is moving things along quickly. I wouldn't be surprised if we get Michael Cohen on the stand the next few weeks, and we could have a verdict not by Flag Day in mid-June, but by Memorial Day.
Oh, wow. All right, Royal Oaks, ABC's news legal analyst, thank you so much for joining us on the line. I appreciate it.
You bet. My pleasure.
So President Donald Trump will be visiting Wisconsin, Jessica, tomorrow. Expected to talk right when Wisconsin's midday news wraps up at 1 p.m. tomorrow.
Waukesha County Expo Center.
Yeah. So I've covered him on three visits, two during his campaigning in 2016, one while he was president, and he spoke right in front of Air Force One. Have you covered the president yet?
I have covered presidents. I have not interviewed Trump specifically. Funny story about that, though. Years ago, gosh, this makes me feel a little bit old, but before he was actually going to run, the first time we ever heard that Donald Trump might run, this was back in the Apprentice days and whatnot, and that was very surprising. Now it's strange to think back then because he's already been president, and here we are today. But anyways, I was like, let's get him on the phone. So I had a phoner set up with Donald Trump, again, well before he was, actually our president, and when people weren't even sure was he really going to run. And then they canceled the phoner. And I was like, what? But he did not end up running that cycle. But then it was later that he did end up running.
Well, he'll be in Waukesha tomorrow if you want to talk to him, Jessica. He plans to talk about the contrast between himself and, quote, Joe Biden's failed presidency. It goes on to say the people of Wisconsin are bearing the brunt of Biden's bad policies. 18.8% inflation is stealing $920 per month from the average Wisconsin household. So that's kind of a look at what Trump's going to be talking about. He says, thanks to Biden's war against American energy, Wisconsinites are paying record prices for electricity and gas. It goes on to foreshadow more about Trump's speech tomorrow in Waukesha, where he will talk about police, safety, immigration, the drug epidemic. His trial was not brought up in the news release. So we'll see if he does. We have Wyatt Barmar-Pooley who will be there. This is Trump's second visit to Wisconsin this year. The first was in Green Bay, so we surely expect many more to come. All right, coming up, it's Do or Die for the Milwaukee Bucks. We'll get you up to date with your top stories, and then digital content manager Dylan Hunter-Carter joins us next.